Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9 to 5 for a 5 to 9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Good Monday afternoon. Welcome into Grant and Danny, June 23rd, 2025. You are listening to The Fan. In an hour, Richard Deitch of The Athletic, who covers sports media, will be on with us. We want to talk about the coverage of the NBA Finals, how the TNT Inside the NBA crew is going to fit in over at ESPN, among other things, in sports media. That's coming up in 1 hour. Danny, we've got a new NBA champion.
Got a champ.
Congratulations to the Oklahoma City Thunder, who won their first title. Pacers' Cinderella run ends one win shy.
I know the story should be Oklahoma City, and it is, ultimately. We'll celebrate them accordingly, and Shea deserved the MVP. That's all correct. They were that run in the third quarter to basically turn the game, and Indiana had no response. I can't stop thinking about Haliburton. Just heartbreaking. I mean, listen, they're real life tragedies. We're all aware of that. We're talking sports within those relative circles. But my God, just it's heartbreaking. Heartbreaking what happened to that guy. All he's trying to do is gut through it. It's reminiscent of Kevin Durant years ago with the strained calf leading to the Achilles. And I haven't seen an update on anything official with the injury, but you could see it in slow-mo. I mean, everything sort of snaps and stops working. You could see it through his sock and his shoe. And it just like, gut-wrenching that it happened. He's on fire to start the game at 3 threes in the first handful of minutes, and you're going, Indiana ain't going anywhere, and then that happens.
He had God. 9 points as of 7 minutes into the game.
Yep.
He had 9 of the 16 for Indiana at the time. They were down by 2 points. And to your point, he was a game-time decision for game six as well. I mean, this was something where he had to decide he wanted to play. They're giving him, I'm sure, an update on his status and telling him, you know, you're risking further injury, but it's up to the player when you get to game six, game seven of an NBA Finals. He only had to play 23 minutes in game six because they fairly inexplicably blew out the Thunder. But to see it all happen, where for the third time we've seen it now in this postseason, where somebody kind of similarly is just making a basketball move and you see the legs snap and that recoil. Remember it from Kevin Durant. It's what you see with quarterbacks, with Rodgers or Cousins or whatever. It's very obvious when you watch it in slow-mo and high def now.
Yep.
The Achilles goes. That was heartbreaking. I don't think I'm overstating that. Like, I don't remember being this crestfallen about a player that's not on my team.
Yeah.
Or a team dealing with an injury on a big stage that isn't mine. Because the Pacers were more fun to watch. They were a better story. I wasn't rooting against the Thunder necessarily because they're still fresh and it's a new cologne and they were so good this year. We'll give them their flowers in a second because that should be the story. But to your point, it really wasn't for me last night. The Pacers were on this legendary, this iconic run with the come-from-behind victories and stealing victories out of the jaws of defeat and Haliburton in the middle of it seemingly every single time. And I did find myself kind of going, man, would it be amazing if they did it one more time? And then he gets off to this ridiculous start to the game. And it was just really, really sad to see it end that way. But you're right. I just don't remember being that heartbroken for a player or a team. And somehow, by the way, that happened 8 minutes in. They led by a point without him at halftime.
Yep.
48-47. Like, they were doing the thing again where I'm going, there's no way,
they just
right?
keep hanging around, right?
Eventually, the Thunder proved to be too much.
And they thundered it, right? Where they forced a million turnovers. You look up and you go, oh my God, we're down 20. When the hell did that happen? The last couple minutes. The whole thing's a blur, right? I mean, Oklahoma City was the best team because they can do that. Whatever gear that is, no one else in the league had that. And it wasn't like Oklahoma City did it once. They did this with one of the great turnover margins in the sport's history. And that's their DNA, right? They're not always great in the half court. They're going to go through some ups and downs, like everyone else is subject to in a league about shooting threes and spacing people out. But it's that vice grip defense. It's the next guy, in this case, Cason Wallace, making unbelievable defensive effort after unbelievable defensive effort. And then Alex Caruso takes a turn. And then, you know, you forget about Dortz, who's, diving. I call him Dortz. Dortz is all over the place, elbowing people and shoving guys aside and diving for loose balls and just making every little hustle play to get their big guns more and more opportunities. they are awesome, and they deserve to be champions. Really, really cool for that young group of guys that's hopefully going to start something really, really neat. But I couldn't escape thinking about Halliburton. I mean, that run for Indiana was reminiscent of Villanova going on and beating Georgetown, reminiscent of NC State surviving in advance, reminiscent of some of the great Cinderella stories, USA Hockey. I mean, that they were underdogs everywhere and always. Every time they took the court, basically, they were underdogs, and they just kept punching back.
Well, I picked against them like 19 times in wins, right? It felt like, in the last month. I mean, they were the four seed, and it was a generational run led by Halliburton, who was hitting more big shots as the centerpiece than Robert Horry. And for the Achilles to go early in that game, it just felt like we were robbed of a classic.
Yeah.
Because in the first 7 or 8 minutes, it was, you know, a boxing match where they're standing in the middle of the ring, blow by blow, right, just landing
Rocky
punches.
Rocky and Apollo just taking turns, haymakers.
You knew in that game on that stage, like, Halliburton's not going away. He's going to keep hitting shots. He's going to keep taking shots. And the only way he did end up going away was because the Achilles just gave on him. But I think it's important to point out for the Thunder, as we dissect how they did this, this was about defense.
Yes.
You know, here we are in a market where the Wizards can't play defense, won't play defense, haven't in years. This Thunder team, for all of the talk about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander as an MVP and some of the firepower that they have, they forced 21 turnovers. This is what they've done all year long.
Mm-hmm.
They stole the basketball 14 times last night. They had a 32-10 edge off of turnovers in this game in scoring, plus 22, 32-10. And that's how they are built.
That's how they're doing
it. By the best GM of his era, probably, at this point. But they are built with harassing, pain-in-the-butt defenders. Alex Caruso, you mentioned Cason Wallace last night. Lou Dort, he'll hit threes. He gets credit for that, but like, he is there to
bother you.
Infuriate you for 36 minutes a night or whatever he's going to play. And then in the second half, to the Thunder's credit, because I kept saying, where is Chet Holmgren? I thought he had a terrible finals offensively. I know with his length, he defends the rim, and he's good on that end of the floor. But finally in the second half, they had 47 points at halftime.
Mm-hmm.
They're down a point to a Pacers team that spent the majority of the half without Tyrese Halliburton on the road in a Game 7 where your whole season's on the line. I couldn't really make sense of that except to say they needed more out of Williams, they needed more out of Holmgren, and they got it. They combined for 28 in the second half. Williams had 15, Holmgren had 13, and that was the biggest reason they went plus 14 in the third quarter. But I do think they won this championship because of their defense.
I do too. Pacers went small for a while when Halliburton went out. It was a lot of McConnell in the lineup. You know, Mathurin got big minutes too, but it was a lot of, you know, Nembhard, Nesmith, you know, and Oklahoma City couldn't really punish them. That, to your point, I'm going to the first half. If Chet Holmgren doesn't step up and do something, they're going to lose this game. Because Indiana's getting away with being small. And,
right,
and he's a full head taller than everyone else
on
the court.
But didn't you think Chet played like that most of the finals?
A lot
I kept waiting for the Chet game, the 25-27 point game.
And Pacers deserve some credit for that, for making him uncomfortable and not giving him, you know, some of those looks. But at some point, dude, come on, man.
So here's my Thunder question, or point, I guess, that I want to get a reaction to. First, I want to give them their flowers, because I don't think we've done that enough, as we've talked a lot about Halliburton and the Pacers. All-time season we just saw.
Yeah.
68 wins to lead the NBA. Superstar guard wins the MVP in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Now you win your first title as an organization coming over to Oklahoma City. By the way, SGA, I thought last night, 16 in the first half, he was the only thing cooking. The only thing they had going is they scored 47 in that half. And then he finishes with a great line, 29-12-5, wins finals MVP. That was a foregone conclusion. He was not efficient. He missed a lot of shots. It really wasn't a good shooting night at all. I want to say he was like something like 6 for 28 from the floor, or whatever it was, or 8 for 28 or something.
Yeah, 8 for 27.
Is that what it was?
Mm-hmm.
Like, not a good shooting night, not efficient, but 29-12-5 every single time, please and thank you. They are great, and I believe this is the first of a few in this window. They're probably going to win 3 or 4. We've had 7 straight new champions. There's a parity in the NBA now that makes it hard to go back-to-back, which I love. But you'd agree with me probably that this is the first of a few, because they've got a guy in Sam Presti running this thing as a GM, drafts better than anybody. The best GM, not only in the NBA.
Playing 3D chess,
I mean, he might be the best executive in sports right now. Like, that's what we're talking about. Is that fair?
Yeah, there's a conversation, sure.
He is a stud. But here is my hot take or whatever. I don't find watching their style aesthetically pleasing. Like, watching them in the playoffs as much as I did in watching the finals closely, see, I don't watch as much of them in the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that fun to me. And what I mean by that, I know that it's kind of the new school NBA, but it's so much like ISO ball. It's so much high pick and roll, and then it's just a lot of SGA ball sticking. And I love him as a dude. I love him as a player. I'm not trying to knock him. But like when the Pacers have the ball, it looks different.
Yes.
And it just looks better. I like it. The ball, there is no like alpha. The ball is constantly moving. They're getting these backdoor looks. It's just a prettier version of basketball. And so I don't even know if I have a big picture point here other than watching this, and it was a great finals, and it was memorable, and screw everyone who wants to talk about the TV numbers. I don't care about them. Give me more of these. But if this is going to be the team for the next 5 years in the NBA, I guess my point is it's going to be a little bit of work because I just don't find them. Like, the Warriors were the most sexy thing to watch.
That's
ever.
What I was going to ask you, because it's like, you know, you think of those Spurs teams with Duncan. Obviously, he's the linchpin, but the ball's flying around. Everybody gets a chance. It's Everyone's going to get fat.
Yeah, and he's Mr. Fundamental, and it's supposedly he's Mr. Boring. There was nothing boring about those teams.
Right. Ginobili wasn't boring. Parker wasn't boring. Yeah, the way those guys are moving and cutting.
But
Golden
don't
State
you agree?
Was the same
it's
way.
Like the same thing. It's like high pick and roll, SGA. I don't know. There's the number has to exist. Some basketball guy could tell me. There's no way anybody has dribbled the basketball more this season than Gilgeous Alexander.
The most dribbles per possession. Yeah, it's probably up there. I mean, yeah, I actually think it's a really savvy point by you. Thinking about how Denver did it, for example, when Jokic is right and healthy and they got all the pieces around him that, again, are right and healthy, where it's him in the high post, it's him up top, it's him kind of everywhere in between. If there's too much attention, the ball's getting flung to the corner for a three for Porter Jr. or getting flung for an alley-oop to somebody. So, yeah, I it's not as much fun when a team is built on turning you over without pressing. It's not like Arkansas 40 minutes of hell style from back in the 90s. It's a half-court vice grip with a bunch of really excellent, limby, long, or physically stout defenders in Dort's case. I think it's a really smart point. I mean, they basically were able to hide Gilgeous Alexander on defense because he's got so much offensive responsibility. Early on in this series, Indiana was getting a lot of things they wanted by basically saying, whoever he's got, that's who's going. So people are going, where's Halliburton? Why isn't he scoring a ton? Didn't matter because Nembhard's taking Gilgeous Alexander off the dribble. Then it was Nesmith's turn. I mean, everybody is going at that guy. They're able to kind of hide him defensively to make it so that it's iso ball on offense. I think you're right, but they remind me a bit, not exactly the same, but they remind me of those UConn teams recently here that won a couple back-to-back titles where you go, all right, we're in this. We're going punch for punch. It's not as if their offensive firepower is too much for us to deal with. They got guys hitting shots, and then you look up and you're down 12, and you go, what just happened? It's that defensive vice grip that takes away shot opportunities for you. That third quarter disparity, I think they missed more shots than Indiana took in the third quarter. It was close to that.
Well, yeah, because that's where a lot of the turnovers and happened. The steals were, for sure. We'll get more into this at 3 with Richard Deitch, but I do want to bring this up really quickly before we move on from the finals. And I'm not alone based on social media, because it seems like a lot of people agree with this. I thought ESPN's television coverage of the NBA postseason in the finals were embarrassing, mostly.
Yep.
You got a lot of like just individual fan analysis from guys that were just like backing their teams. I think it was awful announcing, but somebody did a big piece on this last week where like you had Pat McAfee, who's their superstar all in the middays or whatever, who's just Mr. Pacers. You have Stephen A. Smith, who was just Mr. New York Knicksing it up essentially while they were alive. Kendrick Perkins was like Mr. Thunder, where he played. There's just so much of that, which there's a role for that kind of thing on your staff. In talk radio as an example, there's a little bit more fan takes or fanalist work, I would call it, than, say, on TV. But like Stephen A. Smith screaming at Kendrick Perkins about his take and arguing over whatever it is in the middle of the day on the Bad Shouty Stephen A. Smith show, cool.
Yeah.
Like, let him explore the space. Let him let his hair down, whatever. Why is that the pregame show? And why is their halftime show, and I'm not exaggerating, 4 people talking over each other for minutes at a time? I don't understand how a network executive at ESPN would watch any of that and go,
we did it, guys.
We should ever allow this to happen again. And I don't have nearly as big a problem with the in-game broadcast as everyone else seems to. Like Doris Burke got crushed, who I think is actually pretty solid.
She's really good.
I like Doris Burke. Richard Jefferson, same thing. That Breen 3-man team. Because, by the way, it's hard to build chemistry. It takes time, and this was their first year. But they got demolished by fans. I don't know if that's just Twitter, which isn't real, or basketball fans everywhere. But that's not even my issue. It's the pregame to a lesser extent, but definitely halftime, post-game, I just thought it was awful. And like the days of Stuart Scott with you know, Michael Wilbon sitting there and Bill Simmons and just like basketball insider analyst type, where's Tim Legler or, you know, just someone who can sit there and make analytical points without yelling at each other about dumb sports bar barbershop arguments that don't matter. Like, they're kind of turning all the shows into the midday crap.
Yep.
I hated watching it. And, I thought it was awful.
And I generally try to shy away from, like, when there's a big Twitter pile-on on something. Because a lot of times it's just like, oh, okay, come on, guys. You're complaining because it's a Wednesday or whatever, you know? I think this time everybody's right. I mean, the glaring example, kind of my case in point to sort of kind of slam the gavel and make my case here, is where's Bob Myers from? Golden State, right? Where'd he cut his teeth? Golden State, doing all the things with Golden State. In the finals, a superstar that played for Team USA tried to play through a calf strain and basically, you know, blew his Achilles up for Bob Myers and Kevin Durant. Not a single question. Not a single moment of discussion. It was basically Stephen A. Smith angry that the Oklahoma City Thunder weren't winning. I mean, and you got the resource sitting there. What was it like as an executive? What were the conversations like about him and the risks he was running, playing through this? You know, what sort of conversations were had before the game, during the game, you know, in terms of what can the training staff do? What were the thought processes going through for the player? You know, what sort of conversations were had with his family? None of those things come up. And it's, I don't know what Chet Holmgren's doing. I don't know if they even give a damn about winning because they're 24 minutes away from being embarrassed. And that's the show?
Yeah.
That's what we're doing?
We'll talk to Richard Deitch about it. But remember that they've got inside the NBA's crew coming in. Now, the plan is definitively not to have them do, like, pre or post or anything on the mothership, supposedly. But I don't think everyone's just complaining about this because they're trying to crowbar them in.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have a fix here if they want it. I just don't get who that's for. Like, a lot of people actively avoid their daytime programming, but we tune in for the games and we expect to get analysis that is more smart and I don't know, just analytical and game-oriented and less, like, big-picture, nonsense, time-filling debate stuff. Keep that stuff to the screamy shows, the shouty shows that I'm so good at not watching those, and I don't complain about them because they're on and someone is watching them, and good for them. But now you're going into my time, and you're taking
my time for real
basketball insight. And someone said to me last night, it was a really good point, I tweeted about this, and one of our listeners said, they pay him $20 million a year. What do you expect? They're going to use him on everything. And that's actually probably true.
That's right.
Like, when you pay someone as much as they're now paying, like, Pat McAfee will be sitting there soon enough doing NBA. You know, I'm surprised they didn't have him on the panel, to be honest with you, for one of these games in a tank top, talking about the Pacers, yins, and that. It's just what they're doing now. But it used to be that the games at least could be the game.
There was something sacred. It's not anymore. You're right.
We'll talk to Deitch about that coming up in 40 minutes. Before we move on from hoops, the NBA draft is Wednesday.
Wednesday, dude.
The Wizards have the 6th pick. I want to get into some storylines with that, and then we'll get to everything else. We'll do that next. Grant and Danny on the Fan.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
The Thunder have taken the NBA by storm. For the first time, the NBA champion resides in Oklahoma City. The storybook season is complete.
Mike Breen on the call. NBA Finals last night on ABC. Welcome back to Grant and Danny. NBA season in the rear view, and there's no time down for the association. Just like that, The draft is Wednesday.
Here we go.
Kevin Durant's already been traded to the Houston Rockets. Like, they didn't even wait for the finals for that one. But the draft and the Wizards, let's get into that really quickly, because Wednesday's coming fast. We're going to have a short show for 90 minutes on Wednesday, so we're already getting gypped a little bit on how much of the draft we're going to be able to cover. So, Danny, stop me when you disagree with anything, but it feels to me like picks one and two are already known. Cooper Flagg is going to go one to the Mavericks.
Yep.
That's been months in the making. It was just a matter of who's going to get the pick.
Certainly wasn't Washington.
And the Spurs are going to take Dylan Harper. Flagg's the 6'7 phenom from Duke, who's been the consensus 1-1 for years, and he's going to make his debut, by the way, at 18 years old. Sneaky, way younger than people think.
Uh-huh.
Meanwhile, Harper's the guard from Rutgers, 6'4 with a 6'10 wingspan, who can create his own shot, and he's a good passer, and he can finish. And for those reasons, he's kind of separated himself as the best non-Flagg player in this class. And so he will go second overall to San Antonio and team up with Wemby. So as far as I'm concerned, for my money, the draft officially starts at 3 with the 76ers on the clock. The Wizards don't pick for another couple of spots after that. And they've got to sit around and wait to see what plays out in picks 3 through 5 ahead of them.
Everything I co-sign. There is huge degrees of variance here. I mean, the consensus guy at this point, but again, this is silly season for the NBA. It doesn't last as long or as dramatic as it is with the NFL, where, you know, there's conspiracies and guys are dropping and falling and rising. There's some dramatics with this, which we'll get to. But right now, it seems the consensus is VJ Edgecombe, kid from Baylor, an unbelievably ridiculous athlete, 6'4", shooting guard, can do everything you want. Really, really, you know, high upside player with some production right now, goes 3 to Philadelphia. That's the consensus, but would you bet your mortgage? I wouldn't.
I think the most fascinating storyline is the possibility of Ace Bailey falling.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason this is getting the most attention. It's because Bailey, for a while, was viewed as maybe the number two pick. With the separation for Harper, his teammate from Rutgers, the 6'7 wing is now probably like the number three player in the class. He played the 2 and the 3, 7-foot wingspan, has an upside of being basically a shot-making wing in the NBA. But he has become, in this pre-draft process, a gigantic pain in the butt to teams in the top 5. He's the only American player in this draft class that has not visited a single facility pre-draft of an NBA team. Think about that.
Yeah.
Everyone else is doing it the way it's always been done, the way the draft works, and he's going, nah, I'm good. I'll do it my way. And that's what he's doing. He's trying to reinvent the pre-draft process. He has declined workouts with the 76ers, with Charlotte, with Utah. He is saying, uh-uh, I'm not working out for you. And what people are basically saying, from what I was reading today, he is trying to push his way outside the top 5 to 6 through 8. He likes those teams better as options. That's Washington, luckily, New Orleans, and Brooklyn. So he may not get his way. It very well could be that Philly, Charlotte, Utah, one of those teams grabs him.
Mm-hmm.
He's costing himself by doing this $10 to $15 million, depending on where he would have gone and where he's going to end up. But he's okay. Him and his agents are going, we'll lose the money up front because he's going to make it on the back end in these other markets that we like better, and because the situation's going to be better for him. I guess that, to me, is the most interesting question. If I'm a Wizards fan, 2 days from the draft, what I'm wondering the most is Ace Bailey acting like a malcontent pain in the butt that you don't want to deal with pre-draft just to kind of get where he needs to go, see Charles Barkley or whatever? Or is this the type of guy and teammate and player that he's going to be? And is he interested in Washington?
Yeah,
they have an idea.
Is it just kind of a hyped version of what Alex Sarr did last year, who kind of tried to engineer his way to Washington? It got less press.
That's true.
And less
didn't
dramatic.
Want to go to Atlanta.
Yeah.
That's
so,
a good point.
But again, and I'm not necessarily comping the two, but there's something to that, right? Where a prodigiously talented dude that probably should be talent wise, whether he's 6'7" and 3/4, 6'8", 6'9", I don't know. I don't care. He should be talent wise the second player in this draft. He's not. And we're all trying to figure out like how dramatic this stuff is. Is it smokescreen? Is it that he's really trying to reinvent the process? Is he actually just smart? Like he and his agent just actually playing this well to get what they want out of a process that usually doesn't reward that sort of thing? Or is this that word that you use? Is he, I have no idea. Is it kind of a malcontent who's going to, you know, already be looking at the next destination 3 months into his rookie contract?
I just think it's been a really long time since somebody acted like this before the draft.
Agreed.
The Sarr comp, if we're saying that, is not real or authentic.
No.
He did the Caleb Williams thing, like a little bit of agitating and thinking about what if I did this and how would it affect me. This is literally taking your ball and going home, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you want to take me, but I'm not working out for you. I'm not playing the game. And supposedly, it's so that he can get outside of the top 5 to Washington, New Orleans, or Brooklyn. But if you're the Wizards, what are your interactions with his agent and him like, to the point where do you feel like he wants to play?
Do you feel good about it? Yeah, exactly.
We just don't know. My guy the guy I love is Trey Johnson, the Texas guard. I don't think he'll be there for the Wizards. And they're certainly unlikely, just based on the way the numbers work out, that they would be picking between Ace Bailey and Trey Johnson. Like, mm-hmm. one of them might fall, the other one probably won't. But the shooting guard from the Longhorns would be my dream scenario. He's 6'4 without shoes. He's got a 6'10 wingspan. He can knock down shots from the perimeter. He was a freshman at Texas this year. He led the SEC in scoring, and he shot 43% from the floor and 40% from deep and about 90% from the free throw line. He's got a pure touch. He averaged 20 a game as a freshman, and he can create his own shot. And when I look into these scouting reports for all the knocks on him, it's things like he struggles to handle physicality. He's going to get bigger and stronger. It's things like bad shot selection. He needs to work on his shot selection. Oh, the college player who fills it up from outside as the leading scorer in his conference, takes some bad shots sometimes. Like, those are such fixable things.
Yeah.
I really, really like Trey Johnson. That would kind of be my one seed option.
He's my favorite there. So what has to happen then is, again, it depends on your mock draft, but Charlotte's got to take a Konkanipel, got to take Jeremiah Fears, who a lot of people like out of Oklahoma, really athletic, toolsy point guard.
Kind of Trey Johnson-ish in terms of like guard who can score and work around the perimeter.
And people seem to really, really like Fears, who I know a little bit less about than some of these other guys. But that means, math-wise, Johnson could be there, or Ace Bailey could as well.
Don't you agree, though, that if Bailey were to go 4 or 5, that it would actually be a huge help for Washington to get Johnson?
100%.
Like, that's what I'm counting on.
Then Philadelphia's the variable. I mean, now Utah's the variable.
Today's the first time I actually have thought, and maybe I'll look foolish, that Ace Bailey will fall to the Wizards. And that if they take him, look, I'm not telling you that they hit a home run or that they got Cooper Flagg, but it could work out. Like, there's a potential where it's almost as if they got the second or third pick. Because it was only several weeks ago that Bailey was in the mix at 2. And probably, if you just take all of the red flags and the non-basketball stuff out of it, and you just rank basketball players, a lot of people would have him in the top 3.
I think he's the second most talented player in this draft.
And you'd get him at 6. So that would potentially be a huge win. I just worry about the stuff. It's hard for us sitting here not getting to talk to players and agents and get any intel behind the scenes. So, like, yeah, I'm nervous and I have anxieties about what kind of guy he's going to be. But assuming that all checks out for them, it could be a huge win if he falls right into your lap.
So over the years, and Danny Ainge is a wild card at 5 for the Utah Jazz, right? Like, his scouting mantra, the way he's looked at players over the years, and I've seen some interviews with him and hear people that know him really well talk about this. I think actually Bill Simmons talked about this the other day, that where everyone else sees a problem, he sees the ceiling, right? So a guy like that, Ace Bailey, who could be a high 20s point per game scorer in the NBA. Like, he's that gifted. He'll just go, we'll figure it out, right? Like, the rest of it. Even if he doesn't want to come here, we'll convince him. We'll wow him. We'll build the offense around him. We'll show him, and it'll fit our thing. So maybe there's that's somebody. He could also just say, yeah, I don't want to deal with that. I got that same skill set in Trey Johnson or in Jeremiah Fears, the kid from Oklahoma. You don't know. But at 5, if he gets past 4, talking about Ace Bailey, that could be very intriguing, whether he goes 5 or then 6 to Washington. And if Trey Johnson gets past Charlotte and Utah, I think that would be the Hail Mary. That's the godsend. Actually, I'm going to think both are gone. And I think it's going to be between Fears and Malawatch.
So that's my biggest concern. I was going to say fear, but I'm going to avoid a bad pun there. It's not that I don't even like
your
Fears.
Your biggest Jeremiah?
I just don't think they would take him. And the Konkanipel thing or Malawatch, it's going to be something like that, which I'm not nearly as excited by. But 6th overall, Wednesday night, Wizards going to be on the clock. We've only got a 90-minute show because of Nats baseball out in San Diego on Wednesday, but we're going to give you quality coverage in the days ahead leading up to that draft pick. One of the things I want to talk about later, and maybe we could take calls on into tomorrow because we got a lot going on today, I have seen some rumblings about the possibility of the Wizards trading up. Like, they are interested in going up the board. I don't know who that would be for, which we could discuss, but what would the 6th pick and, say, Bilal Coulibaly get you? And is that something they should even consider? Is that a guy that should be on the table to go way up the board? But there's a lot of different conversations we can have about the Wiz in that regard. Next, wait till you hear how much money Josh Harris spent and on what this weekend. You're listening to Grant and Danny on The Fan.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
G&D, welcoming you back on The Fan. We had the founder of Fanatics on the show a few weeks ago, actually, talking about what was going to be taking place at Fanatics Fest. Michael Rubin saying that they were spending an ungodly amount of money, basically, to make it the biggest party in the history of sports. Did you see any of the videos or coverage of what happened?
I did. What a spectacle. Kudos to those guys for figuring it out, right?
Tens of thousands of fans in lines to meet players, and hundreds of the biggest names in sports and athletics and with different teams all showing up. I mean, it really was a Comic-Con kind of deal, but for sports. I would have loved to have been there, frankly. It was up in New York City, and maybe I'll go next year. It did seem like it was maybe a little even too crowded for my liking, but that having been said, there were just so many superstars there and panels, and it looked really, really cool. But I bring this up, Danny, because during the second night of Fanatics Fest over the weekend, Jaden Daniels, who was on site throughout the entire weekend, and Josh Harris, the owner of the Commanders, show up on stage with the CEO of Fanatics, Michael Rubin. And he grabs a mic and he asks, I don't really know what trade night is, but I think this was a big like memorabilia and cards portion of the event. And they had a bunch of people with some of the best cards on the market, essentially, that came together, and he asked who had the best, rarest Jaden Daniels card. And this guy named Josh Roth, who owned a Daniels one of one. I don't know a lot about cards, but I'm guessing it's the only one of its kind. That's what that means.
Or it's a DeSean Jackson.
Black finite prism card of Jaden Daniels, one of one. 2024 Panini Prism. I guess that's the type of card. And he's like, I've got the most rare Jaden Daniels card here. And so Ruben says, okay, well, how much will you sell it for? I got Josh Harris and Jaden Daniels right here. They want the card. And he initially said $2 million. And he tried to comp it to a Paul Skeens one of one that had just gone for $1.1 million during a Topps event that they'd had. It was a Topps Chrome Update MLB debut patch autograph card. So like Skeens' first game ever with a piece of his jersey and an autograph. Can you imagine pulling that card, by the way?
No, that seems pretty good.
And then it's appraised.
Hey, Mom, look at what I just got.
I don't know if it was appraised or sold, but it went for, $1.1 million. And so this guy, Roth, says, the Jaden Daniels, I want $2 million. Like, well.
Shoot your shot, dude. Love that.
I'm not so sure about that.
Like, if Grant and Nanny are bidding, it's like, what do you guys give me? But like, you got the owner right there? Yeah.
The most recent appraisal he'd gotten was from the Reddit founder, who I guess said he'd be willing to pay $250,000 for it. Like, that's how much the card was worth to him and he would pay. They grade these cards on like a 1 to 10 level. So a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are into cards right now. It's gotten massive again. I'd love to get my little guy into it. And, we'll be casual with it. But I know a lot of people my age are suddenly like marks again for card collecting. It seems like an expensive hobby and a little bit like gambling, and I already do a lot of that and probably lose too much money as it is. So I'm not sure if that's the game I'm going to get heavy into. But this card was graded by Beckett. You remember Beckett?
Sure.
The book you thumb through to see what your card is worth. I get a Ryan Leaf. It's worth $300.75 from Spotsylvania Mall or whatever. Well, it's worth, apparently Beckett grades it as a 9.5 card out of 10. So 9 and above is like elite, no blemishes. 8, not great. Anything lower than that, you get dinged a whole bunch. So I tell you all this to say that the owner of the Commanders, Josh Harris, then decides, I'll give you $500,000 for the thing right now. And he and Jaden Daniels agree. Daniels will sign a jersey for this guy, Josh Roth, and Harris is going to pay him $500,000 for this card. And they're then going to display this card at Northwest Stadium for all of you guys to see when you go out to the game. And so they strike this deal.
That's pretty amazing.
Right there in front of everyone at Fanatics Fest, the owner of the Commanders dropped $500,000.
On a decoration.
On a football card to display somewhere, I don't even know where, at the stadium, just like that. Like, I go to the store and I'm like, you know what I want? I want a new grill. And I'm looking at Home Depot and it's like $350 and I'm like, I can't do this. Like, I really want a Traeger. Those things are like $800-$900. Those are super nice. That's out of the price range.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just getting a nubby. I'm just going to get a $300. I want charcoal and propane. I'm like, okay, probably can't do that. Josh Harris walks in and he's like, card, $500,000?
I'll take every grill you've ever had.
Just an amazing weekend for Josh Harris scooping up the Jaden Daniels card.
That's
what do you
so
think?
Wild. I think it's so neat. Now, some are just going to roll their eyes. You're like, oh, what a waste of money or whatever. But, I mean, to me, the whole point of it was it's a celebration of Jaden Daniels. You're not buying like a Todd Rutledge card or something like that, you know, like some backup number. You're right. Buying like a superstar.
Well, wasn't he just kind of also being a showman at the event?
That's
part of it. Was like,
yeah. But it's also that it's not going to hide away in some, you know, locked office somewhere, like in some safe. This is a display for all of us. The whole point is, like, you're enhancing our shared experience. And the thing that I've admired the most about Harris and Rails and Ein and Magic Johnson and company that, you know, have gotten this thing, they understand that they own it. Of course they do. You spent an outrageous amount of money. It took all the money and everybody pulling together every bit of liquid they had to get this thing done, to get it over the finish line. I saw that. But they also get that it's our thing. I know I don't own it. I'm very aware. I got no receipts. I got no deposits. I've never like paid any money towards a fraction of ownership. I don't have any of those Green Bay Packers stupid pieces of paper that when they need some cash. But these guys understand that this is part of this big public trust. And they're caretakers. They own it, and they know that. But there's a sharing with us, and we all get to partake in it to a degree that they're kind of embracing, and that's another example of that to me. That's the first thing I thought of.
I think that's actually a really good point. And I think this is symbolic. It's a good observation of what they talk about all the time, that there is some fiduciary responsibility mm-hmm. that they have with the fan base, with the city, and they really do view this as an obligation that they have to return this thing to the form it once had, but also just to do right by the fan base. And so in their minds, I mean, think about the I don't know if you guys saw this, but like Jaden Daniels, there were thousands of Commanders fans there. And maybe they're not even Commanders fans. Maybe they're just other market Jaden Daniels fans. But the amount of Commanders 5 jerseys that were around the stage for the events that he took part in mm-hmm. was astounding to me. He was one of the more popular events at the guys at the event. And I think in their minds, they're going, let's give people a chance to really celebrate Jaden by having this card on display for them. Let's go to Brandon, who's in Warrington on G&D. What's up, Brandon?
How we doing, gents?
Hey, dude.
Doing well.
So I'm actually one of the few people in the world that owns a Jaden Daniels 1-of-1.
Oh, you have a 1-of-1 Daniels card?
I do.
Wow.
I pulled it in a single pack that I bought from Panini. So
can I
was
have
actually
it?
At Fanatics Fest as well.
Can
so
I have
I saw
the
that
card?
Whole thing go down. Can you have the card? Yeah, you can see it. Sure.
You can't touch it with your hands,
though. Do you have any idea? Yeah. Have you gotten it appraised or like the Beckett or somebody look at it for the quality yet?
So I have. I sent it off to PSA, which is typically the gold standard along with Beckett. And I actually graded a gem. It graded a perfect 10.
No
so,
way.
Dude.
Yes.
So,
PSA charged me for the $25,000 valuation level. So I'm right around the $25,000 to $45,000.
So you buy a pack for, maybe $10 to $50, depending on how many cards you got or whatever. The
correct.
Greatest investment of all time, you pull this card and it's worth $25,000.
Yes. In one word. Yes.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah,
so what's so special? What kind
of
card is
there's
it?
There's a ton of luck.
Of course.
Of course,
Panini.
Totally.
Panini Donruss Optic. Panini Prism is the one that Roth had, and that's like the gold standard product. Everybody loves Prism. That was the first one that Panini came out with back in 2012, I think.
But, I mean, is there a special? Did he autograph it? Is there a part of a jersey on it, or is it just a normal card?
So that's another thing that you get into. Panini is actually losing their licensing. Topps is picking all of that up, Fanatics. And Jaden Daniels is an exclusive with Topps and Fanatics. So he does not sign for Panini. That is actually a non-signed card. It's just a 1-of-1.
Wow.
But it's still just as desirable as one with his ink on it.
Good nuggets. By the way, Brandon, knows what he's talking about when it comes to cards. That guy's got a one-of-one card worth 25 Gs.
That's pretty neat.
I get sized for that.
But can you imagine sending that off somewhere? Just like, oh, just put it in the mail. Like, I would be so nervous
to
stuff that in an envelope or whatever.
My buddy pulled a one-of-one Caitlin Clark that he thought was going to be worth $30,000. He sent it off. They appraised it as like basically a 7.
I'm glad you have it.
They said it was an issue. And he's like, no. And they show him this mark. And he's like, that mark wasn't there when it went to you guys. You know, so it's a whole big ordeal now.
Oh, my God.
By the way, Darius, grab that guy's info. Let him know. I'll give him my address, and he could just ship the card over to me. I don't think he understood when I'd asked. I wanted the card, not to see it.
Yeah.
I don't think he got that.
He got confused. You could tell him I have a 20 in my wallet.
$20.
I have $20.
That should do it.
Yeah.
Richard Deitch, sports media coverage for The Athletic. Want to talk about the very unpopular work of the ESPN basketball crew during the NBA Finals. Next on Grant and Danny.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.